Welcome to a special edition of the Issue Is podcast. This is a bonus episode, which is focused on something that we recorded called Pulse of the People. It's an hour-long town hall meeting with California Senator Alex Padilla, who came into our studios. I'm joined for the episode by KTVU's Greg Lee, who's my co-host. And we solicited questions from viewers of both Fox 11 Los Angeles and KTVU in the Bay Area to ask the senator. This is part of an initiative that Fox stations are doing around the country. And this is the California version of it. We talk about a lot of different topics, from COVID to schools to Afghanistan to homelessness. And so it really runs the gamut. And here it is in its entirety. Pulse of the People.
Pulse of the People, a nationwide initiative from Fox television stations, connecting you and lawmakers in conversation. Tonight, our exclusive town hall discussion, Senator Alex Padilla answering your questions on the biggest topics affecting your family, from California to Capitol Hill. This is Pulse of the People.
And good evening. Welcome to Pulse of the People. I'm Alex Michelson from Fox 11 Los Angeles, host of our statewide political show, The Issue Is.
And I'm Greg Lee with KTVU Fox 2 in the Bay Area. For the next hour, we are getting answers to your questions on COVID, the homeless crisis, climate change and wildfires, and so much more.
Here to answer your questions is the senator from California, Alex Padilla. Great to have you here.
Good to see you both. Happy first day of school, at least for those of us in Los Angeles Unified.
Yeah, yeah. Very exciting. Senator, we want to get to that. There's a lot of California-centric questions ahead of us, but we first want to start with the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and we have seen these horrific images coming out of Afghanistan today. The president had basically said before that this wasn't going to happen, where the Taliban would just take over so quickly. Why did he get it so wrong, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I've seen the images, I've been seeing them unfold all weekend long, and I think the attention right now is being paid where it needs to be paid, right? The safe withdrawal of American citizens from Afghanistan, federal employees, and frankly, partners. You know, one of the bills I've been working on for the last several months is how to expedite the visa process and timetable for interpreters, other Afghanis that supported our mission there. How do we make sure that they are withdrawn safely? Because we know it wouldn't be pretty for those that might be left behind. So, you know, when I heard the president say a situation like what's unfolded was highly unlikely, I think there was an acknowledgement there. It's quite possible, unlikely, but boy, it's been kind of the worst case scenario playing out.
Yeah.
Senator, I want to ask you, when you have veterans and people who served in Afghanistan, family members who have lost loved ones in this war, what do you tell them as they're watching these scenes unfold and they're just aghast about what all this sacrifice was for?
Yeah, no, it's difficult. And look, my office, which is on standby, by the way, to help anybody who knows somebody, has a family member trying to evacuate, padilla.senate.gov is our website. And so we hear from a lot of veterans and military service members and their families as well. And it's pretty mixed. You know, a lot of people who, after 20 years of service and sacrifice, right, more than 2,000 fatalities, more than 20,000 who sustained injuries, at least physical injuries. We know the mental health toll is even greater. There's a lot of service members who are saying, finally, you know, what was our mission there to begin with anyway? What was that again? Remind me why we're still there two decades later. And those, of course, who did serve, many who sacrificed, who felt this is not how we wanted to leave.
But our mission to begin with was to keep us protected from Al-Qaeda. This was a safe haven for Al-Qaeda before September 11th. Right. You're a member of the Homeland Security Committee. Are you concerned that this could become a safe haven for Al-Qaeda again? We see prisoners being released from their jails. Yeah. What do you say to people that are concerned about that?
That's a very legitimate question. The concern is a very valid one. It's been 20 years, and there has not been a 9/11 on our soil type of incident in the last 20 years. But was it going to be a permanent presence there? I don't think that was ever in the plan under Democratic presidents, under Republican presidents. And so, look, when the dust settles, we'll go back and argue, was it the right decision? Was it the right time for him, et cetera? As I said, right now, I think the attention is where it needs to be, and that's getting folks out safely.
Senator, obviously there's a lot of concern as we shift gears to COVID about the Delta variant, the spread, sort of a race versus variants and vaccines. And I think we want to get to a viewer question.
Yeah, and this is a question from Richter about what to do about people who are refusing vaccinations.
All right.
I'd be wondering what he's planning to do on people who aren't willing to get vaccinated, you know, what the plan is for that.
What's the plan?
Look, we're all in this together. There's, you know, federal ideas and policies in place, state leaders, of course, local leaders in Los Angeles County. Folks are going even further with reinstating the mask mandates, et cetera. Look, first of all, it's important to get good information out there. One of the challenges from the beginning of COVID was the impact of disinformation. No, COVID is not a hoax. Yes, the vaccines are safe, right? That was what I got mine months and months ago, and I'm thankful for it. And it's effective. It works. We've seen the big difference between those who haven't been vaccinated in terms of them getting the Delta variant, transmitting the Delta variant, and those who did get the vaccine. Second, vaccines need to be made more available. That's why I was thrilled that one of the first actions I took as a member of the Senate was to vote on the American Rescue Plan to help fund the manufacturing, the distribution, the administration of vaccines. Clearly, there's a lot of folks who still aren't convinced, who don't want to get it. I think these policies, you know, Governor Newsom was one of the first that said, you know, state employees required to be vaccinated or submit to weekly testing, you know, to be the first state to say teachers need to be vaccinated or submit to weekly testing. You're going to see more governments, more private sector employers moving in that direction until we hit much higher thresholds of a vaccinated population.
I mean, I want to ask you about that. You talk about some of these local approaches. Starting on Friday, San Francisco will require in a lot of indoor settings for people to show proof of full vaccination, not just one shot. LA said to be mulling that idea. Is that the right direction to go? And could you see the federal government stepping in that way?
Potentially. But look, here's, you know, for anybody who has a question or maybe is frustrated at these ongoing changes, it's been more than a year. It's been a difficult year for all of us in so many different ways. Ultimately, the answer to these questions depends on us. If each and every one of us did what we're supposed to do, just follow the advice of the public health experts, you know, we didn't have to be here, but we are. How soon we're going to get over the hump depends on, you know, for those who haven't been vaccinated, what are you waiting for? Make your appointment. It is free. You don't need to show proof of insurance. Get it done. For those who have been vaccinated, thank you, thank you, thank you. But let's continue to follow, whether it's distancing, mask guidelines, until the numbers come down for
good.
But
Greg, we've got a question about the fact that there's still a lot of people who aren't listening.
Yeah, this is Andrew Chabon, who wants to figure out the best way to go about this.
How do we do that? Instead of still saying we're going to do this, we're going to do that. No. How do we get everybody as a society to say, okay, we understand the problem. We're going to set that aside. And it's not throwing money at it. It's not anything else. It's got to come from a feel-good situation, which I don't know if it's, you know, high-profile stars, whether it's influencers we could use, however we go about it. But we have to utilize these resources because it's not getting done. I mean, look how long this has been here, you know, and it breaks my heart.
Yeah, he's onto something. He's onto something. It's not just the good information, but sort of who is it that you're hearing from? You know, in 2020, tough, difficult year from a COVID perspective, but nonetheless, you know, when I was still serving as Secretary of State, how did we get good information out there about, you know, options for voting, right? Just government officials talking and talking. It works for a lot of people, but not for everybody. It was also a census year. We needed people to participate in the census. Mm-hmm. And so whenever there's these big, massive campaigns, we do need different message carriers. Who are the trusted voices? For some people, it could be celebrities. For some people, it's community leaders or local elected officials, you know, or a social media influencers, as he said. It's an all of the above approach. And back to my point earlier, now it's on all of us to each do our part.
And, you know, COVID impacted schools in such a big way last year. Now we are finally returning to in-person learning, including your own kids with your drop-off today for the first day of school. Before we get into all that, what was that like for you? What's that like for your kids? And do you feel safe with them in school right now?
So, look, we do feel safe because the protocols are being implemented. There's still distancing, mask requirements, especially for kids that aren't old enough to get the vaccine. But is there some concern? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So glad to hear not just the governor's announcement last week, but LA Unified specific vaccine requirements for teachers and all school personnel. Lucky, we feel blessed that, my wife's been vaccinated, I've been vaccinated, my mother-in-law, my dad, our extended family, everybody's done their part to try to stay as safe as possible. And God, we're just praying that the numbers stay down, that the kids can continue to go to school in person. We did our best last year. We have three boys, remote schooling, click on your Zoom, turn your camera back on, pay attention.
Right.
It was difficult. I can't imagine how much more difficult it was for folks that didn't have as good of an internet connection, maybe, or aren't as literate with all the apps that they needed to have functioning simultaneously to keep up with what was going on in the classroom.
Right.
You can absolutely tell ABCs and 1-2-3s are the easy part. The social development that kids missed out on was tough, and we're going to be making up for that for a long time to come.
Right.
So if we can keep the kids in person, that'd be great for the kids and for parents. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But it requires all of us doing our part. Get vaccinated. Keep your mask on for now. We'll get through this together.
Senator, we want to go to another question. We have Jennifer, who's concerned about what we do if that happens at her child's school.
My son is a senior in a high school of 2,100 kids, and I'm pretty nervous about that, and I'd like to know what their plan B backup is before an outbreak happens.
Yeah. Plan A is to try to avoid another outbreak or epidemic, which is why we continue to hear from leaders, elected and otherwise, so much emphasis on vaccines. We know they work, but they only work if you get it. So get your two rounds. While CDC determines, what's next, is there going to be a booster, or in a year from now, what do we need to do? So the first step is each of us doing our part and reminding each other, holding each other accountable.
Sure.
For kids 12 years and older, you can sign up. So high schoolers, they can and should be vaccinated. Let's hope that we don't lose another year of graduations and proms and all those great memories for yet another class of kids.
But there are people that say, okay, there's still people that aren't getting vaccinated. What happens if there's an outbreak? We heard that from a lot of people that are concerned my kid's school is going to get shut down again.
Yeah, look, that's quite possible. More than 600,000 lives lost to COVID in the United States of America alone. It's a once-in-a-century global health pandemic. I'm not saying this last year and a half was easy. It was hard.
Right.
It was hard for a lot of us that are blessed, resource-wise and everything else. But I'd rather go through that and keep our families alive and healthy. But if it can be avoided, let's do that. And that means getting, holding our friends, holding our neighbors, holding our own family members accountable.
You suggested this a little bit, which is this distance learning and how hard that was for a lot of folks, especially folks with special needs. We got a question about that.
What are you going to do for children in public schools throughout the U.S., like kids in the autistic spectrum, ADHD, dyslexic, physical impairment, and just all kids in general with this long-distance learning, all this stuff going on?
How do we make up for all the loss? And kids with special needs especially hurt.
Right. Look, one of the dynamics of COVID, as devastating as it was from a health perspective, as devastating as it was for a lot of families from an economic perspective, I think one of the good things it's done from a policy perspective, it's exposed a lot of underlying inequities that we've had in society since long before COVID, whether it was, unequal access to school resources, to access to healthcare, job opportunity. So education, as we've been trying to, close the learning gap for kids in different communities, young students with special needs especially have been impacted by this difficult remote learning. So let's not just get to the other side of COVID, and think it's done. you know, what can we do going forward to bring more equity in terms of resources and support and academic performance for kids with special needs? So I appreciate the question. I really do. But it's not just through the lens of COVID. This one is a bigger policy issue that we need to stay focused on.
So what's the answer?
Look, the answer is, you know, more resources. The answer is, you know, what are the best practices when it comes to curriculum and instruction for children with special needs, and make sure that more schools, more school districts are adopting those and helping those young students and their families learn better and prepare them for a better life in the years ahead.
Senator, you talk about inequities. One of the things that a lot of people are concerned about as you drive around California is the homelessness issue, such a major problem. You introduced a bill with Senator Feinstein to address the root causes of homelessness. What are those, and what needs to be done to get to the other side of COVID, but better?
Yeah, so there's a couple of categories that I invite people to think about. Number one, when it comes to homelessness, it's not just a housing unaffordability problem, because we are in a crisis when it comes to affordability, but that's part of it, whether it's can people afford a home? Or how are we building more affordable housing, for example? Los Angeles seems like the most expensive place to build affordable housing in for people experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. So we go back to basic economics, the laws of supply and demand, right? We don't have enough supply out there, not for affordable housing, not for housing in general. And so we need to be back in the supply business. The federal government, I think, is doing a good chunk of its part in providing resources for the development of housing. The state, I know, is pushing in that direction. It's a big priority of the governor. And we need local governments to embrace the construction of more housing, not put up roadblocks whenever there's a development that is proposed. Number two, the root causes of homelessness. Some people think, oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of people who are substance abusers. Look, there's a good number, but it's not everybody, right? Or look, it's how rampant mental health conditions are in society. Well, that's a good chunk, but that's not everybody. It's a combination of reasons why people end up homeless. And so therefore, the solutions to that need to be comprehensive as well. A roof overhead is a starting point, but why do people get there? Is it because they need maybe job training for a better, more sustainable job? Is it health care, including mental health care? Is it you know, some sort of counseling? You know, let's get at those root causes to get people off the street, not just for a night, not just for a week or a month, but for a more productive life.
So there's not one blanket solution.
Not one blanket. The wraparound services is what we're talking about now in the housing conversation. And all the more reason why we're not just investing in physical infrastructure at the federal level, but investing in American families to make sure we can give people a better shot at success.
Eddie had a question about homelessness.
I've noticed a big increase in just the general homeless population, and I understand that there are economic issues and things like that, but I'm just wondering what they plan to do about the homeless problem.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up the issue of housing. There are a lot of folks that say this state is way too regulated, and it makes it hard to build in this state because of that. A lot of the Republicans running in the recall election say we need to amend the regulations in this state, make it easier to build. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, do. Well, I mean, I do think there's some changes that can make it easier and more quick to get those approvals, to be able to break ground. It's always been a delicate balance between sort of state mandates and local control. You know, local cities can, you know, they're trying to maintain the you know, what the communities feel like at a local level, right? Big cities, small cities all around. But at the end of the day, every city needs to do its part in terms of the supply situation. Our population is growing.
So what kind of changes?
What kind of changes? Well, there's a lot of incentives, particularly in urban areas, right, where we're building out rail and bus systems. It makes sense to talk to any city planner to densify areas along those routes and especially around those stations. Yeah. So, you know, without, you know, sprawl, getting into more natural spaces or places that interface with wildlife or wildfires these days, let's densify some of the urban centers, especially as we're investing in more efficient public transportation.
We got to take a quick break, but we've got more of our exclusive one-hour town hall with Senator Alex Padilla.
Up next, one of the most important and most emotionally charged issues in our state, immigration.
And a little later, so much concern about climate change and impact it's having on this state, especially when it comes to wildfires.
Welcome back to Pulse of the People, a town hall event with Senator Alex Padilla.
Senator, thanks again for being here. We want to talk about an issue that so many people have become unfortunately acquainted with during this pandemic, and that's unemployment. And some of the calls, many of the calls that we receive to our newsrooms, are people frustrated that in California it has become so difficult, fraught with fraud. I know this is a state issue, but what could you tell your constituents about what the federal government can do to get people the resources they need?
Yeah, so again, go to our website, padilla.senate.gov. We have a whole team of folks in the state responding to constituent concerns, constituent issues, whether it's the federal government or state government issue. We have contacts at different departments and agencies to try to move things along. I've heard the same, not just the concern, the problem about fraud and what it's cost state taxpayers, but people sort of waiting much longer than they need to wait to get the resources that they're eligible for, right? We're all paying to the unemployment system. It's that we can benefit it if we're in those circumstances. COVID's been tough from a health perspective and an economic perspective for so many. So if we can help get those checks that you deserve, we want to be there to help.
All right, let's talk for a moment about the recall. You were appointed by Governor Newsom, the first Latino senator in the state's history. I know you and the governor are close. We've seen in recent polls that Latinos are actually in favor of the recall. Why do you think that is? And how do you change that before September 14th?
Yeah, well, I think we've seen a mixture of polls. Yeah. But in all of them, I guess the bottom point is the work is cut out for the governor and his team to make sure that we're communicating to voters. Right. That's what the campaigns are all about. At the beginning of a campaign, people think they may know who they want to vote for. A lot of people are undecided. I think that's the case in a lot of these polls as well. And during the course of the campaign, once people hear what's at stake, I'm convinced that recall will be defeated. You know, from a national perspective, here's, you know, an important lens, I think, for the conversation. Same way the Republican Party has been trying to grab power in Arizona through this sham of an audit, you know, or the way they're advancing voter suppression laws in Georgia and Texas and elsewhere. They know that in California, that's not going to fly. So they're trying to abuse the recall because they don't stand a chance in a regular election. Now, that being said, this recall is real. It's qualified.
It's legal. Constitutional.
And on September 14th, you know, that's the last day to vote. Most people will vote by mail. But September 14th is technically the end of Election Day. Here's what's at stake. Do we want to go backwards on a lot of the issues that California has led on, whether it's how we embrace immigrants, how we tackle climate change, how we expand health care and more, or do we want to go backwards on those policies? Because that's really what the forces behind the recall would like to do on issues of equality, voting rights, on and on and on.
Senator, I want to ask you, a lot of the candidates in this recall election have criticized the handling of COVID by the governor, and that's kind of what drove a lot of the signatures on this recall petition. Do you believe there were missteps or things that could have been handled differently?
Well, let's be clear. You know, are they disapproving of how the governor handled COVID? Yes, because here's what happened. Governor Newsom was the first governor in the nation to take the bold actions necessary to protect us, keep us safe early on in the pandemic. Whether it was the stay-at-home orders or, you know, the mask recommendations and mandates, those sorts of things. That's why for a good chunk of last year, despite having the most populous state in the nation, the COVID rates were on the much lower end of the spectrum when it came across the country. Was that inconvenient? Absolutely. Was it frustrating for parents homeschooling? Let's bring that up again. Absolutely. And if that's what led you to want to say, you know, let's get rid of this governor, I'm sorry. We just disagree. And I think most Californians are going to see it for what it is.
Are you going to be campaigning over the next month?
If asked, I will be there. So, yes, I am against the recall. It's nothing but a power grab, in my opinion. And I think the best thing for the people of California is to keep Governor Newsom.
All right, let's talk about an issue, immigration, which you're so familiar with. A lot of people don't know your personal story, and let's take a moment to talk about that and show some video in the process as well. You grew up in Southern California. Your dad, a short order cook. Your mom, a housekeeper. You're the first Latino senator in the history of California, as we mentioned, a state that is now majority Latino. The last time you and I were together, we were on board the USS Iowa. This was a naturalization ceremony for immigrants there, which is a beautiful thing, right before July 4th. Your parents once prepared for this. You helped prepare them for it. Right. You brought your son Diego out there as well, which was cool to see him to watch all of this. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, Have you had any moments where maybe you're with some of your white colleagues and you talk about or think about immigration issues in a different way than they do when you're in the Senate? I mean, how does that change your perspective?
Look, I don't think a day goes by without having at least one of those moments. To your point, and whether it's me trying to bring up a different perspective on something that we're talking about, or some of my colleagues sort of acknowledging what my presence has meant for them as they learn my life story and the perspective I'm bringing, not just on behalf of myself or my family, but it's pretty indicative of California.
Right.
Right. There's more people in California than any other state in the nation. There's more immigrants in California than any other state in the nation. Yeah. And by the way, when we talk about California being the fifth largest economy in the world, that is not a coincidence. That's also a result of the economic contributions that immigrants have made to California via the workforce, via our spending, via our entrepreneurship, et cetera. So that is another significant reason why immigration reform has been such a top priority of mine.
Is there a specific story, though, or a specific moment where you're standing in the senator and the Senate and somebody says something to you and you're like, that is not how this goes at all?
No, I'll tell you. I will try to be brief with this one story, and the senator shall remain nameless just out of respect.
Oh, that's more fun. That's not as fun.
But I will say this to a colleague from across the aisle.
Okay.
Saying, look, I'm not anti-immigrant. In my state, we rely on immigrants, this industry, that industry, et cetera. And trust me, look, I know immigrants. They come here to work hard. They want to do good. They have kids who grow up to be pretty successful. Some become teachers. Some become firefighters. Some will even become a supervisor at the same plant that their parents work in. And I kind of paused and I said, and one could even grow up to be United States Senator someday. And there was that palpable, like, okay, I get this now moment. Mm.
Senator, we want to get back to some viewer questions. This is from Ken and says, please ask what he's doing to reduce the huge backlog in legal immigration, including 10-year green cards and naturalization. What help you can offer your constituents in this regard? Routine applications are taking years, he says.
Right. And in large part because of how those departments and agencies were starved for the last 4 years. And so working with my colleagues, trying to fund those departments and agencies with more staff, more capacity to process those applications on a much more timely basis. That's number one. Number two, for the people who may distinguish, well, there's quote unquote illegal immigration versus legal immigration. The reason people feel sometimes compelled to come not through the normal process is because of how long it's taking for the legal. So we got to fix the legal immigration system, not just the laws of who's eligible, et cetera, but capacity for us to handle, visa applications, naturalization applications, asylum requests, and more.
Right. And we've seen these horrific images from the border of a lot of these people. That's a real humanitarian crisis, right? Hundreds of thousands of people coming per month. An estimate there could be 2 million people coming in that are migrants this year alone. And one thing I've heard from a lot of the folks at the border is that they need more immigration judges, mm-hmm. that it could take years before these people get before a judge. Is there any thought at the federal level, let's put some more money into this, let's get some more judges out there and actually come to some sort of deal on something that seems like both parties could agree on?
The answer is absolutely yes. And part of that is included in these budget proposals for the next fiscal year that we're in the process of negotiating. So that's really what I mean by capacity, not just the judges themselves, but where are more judges going to work? Right. They need more office space, more, courtrooms, which take a minute to build. They don't just open from one day to the next. And then the support staff that's necessary for the proper administration of it all. But, it's a short term. We've got to respond to, yes, the situation at the border, the increase in numbers, and make sure it's done in a humane way, not a cruel way. But for the long term, recognize that, we need to get rid of the backlog. It's not just people who are coming to the southern border in the last few months. What about the nearly 12 million people who have been here, adults on average, by the way, for 18 years working, paying taxes? In my opinion, essential workers, farm workers, TPS holders, dreamers have earned a pathway to citizenship and the right to live without fear of deportation. But it's going to take investing in, the federal departments and agencies to process those that paperwork.
A process your own parents went through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's been a few years, but it took them nearly 30 years to finally decide to begin that process, a couple years to get through it. they were fortunate. Everybody today working equally hard with those same aspirations deserve better treatment.
Senator, we got to take another quick break, but more than 100 large fires are burning in the West. The biggest is the Dixie Fire in Northern California.
The drought and bone dry conditions are making containment that much harder for firefighters. Your questions on wildfires, climate change when we come back.
The Dixie Fire in Northern California is threatening thousands of homes. The fire started more than a month ago and has burned more than 570,000 acres across four counties. More than 1,000 homes and businesses have already been destroyed.
The drought and drier conditions have helped fuel these fires. Welcome back to the Pulse of the People. I'm Alex Michelson from Fox 11 Los Angeles.
And I'm Greg Lee from KTVU Fox 2 in the Bay Area. Tonight, we're getting questions answered on important issues facing California from Senator Alex Padilla. Now we turn our attention to fires and climate change.
And we have a question from one of our viewers on that topic. Let's go to Carrie.
I'm wondering what can be done either at the state or the federal levels regarding California's wildfires, not just emergency funding or measures happening after the fact, but what can be done and what is being done to help address and prevent the wildfires as part of global warming and climate change.
I know you're going to visit the Dixie Fire this week.
She's got it absolutely right, Carrie. It's both what are we doing short term, immediate term, responding to the current fire, but also what can we do longer term to try to prevent or mitigate future fires of this magnitude. In the short term, the emergency resources, the personnel, working to not just increase the size of the federal firefighter workforce, but pay them better. So it's a more attractive job for people willing to work in that particular field and recognize that there's no longer wildfire season in California. The threat is really all year round. So it's not a matter of bringing firefighters on a temporary basis when the wildfires break out, but a lot of the prevention mitigation work that can be done around the year to contain the impact of future wildfire years. That's in the short term. Mm-hmm. Longer term, climate change. The reason the fires are so bad is because we have the extreme heat and drought conditions, in large part the result of climate change. And so learning from California's leadership on climate policy, trying to get the federal level to adapt more renewable energy, right, reduced emissions, not just in the electricity sector, in the transportation sector, and other sectors. One particular example, because this is a great example of how that prior experience really comes into play. You know, one of the measures included in this bipartisan infrastructure framework that we just passed would help school districts transition from diesel school buses to zero emission school buses. That technology exists today. It's being deployed now. Imagine we can retire those diesel buses, better for the environment, better for our public health, right? Less diesel exhaust that our kids are breathing in, and then better for their academic performance because healthier kids learn better.
Senator, talking about the here and now, you've asked the Department of Homeland Security to ensure FEMA has the resources California needs to fight this wildfire season, as well as asking to handle these jet fuel shortages that we're seeing all across the state for these aircraft that fight these fires. What was the response you've gotten, and do you feel comfortable with where we're at?
Well, the response is always, you know, yes. And so I am comfortable thus far, but it's a matter of staying on top of them, not just as the fires grow or evolve. The situation on the ground may change. Our needs as a result may change. Maybe it's more firefighting equipment in the air. Maybe it's more personnel on the ground, or a combination of both. And of course, at some point, it's going to be the reimbursement of a lot of these expenditures due to emergencies once they are formalized. But thus far, the administration has been very responsive.
Mona has a question.
Senator Padilla, given the UN's recent report on climate change accelerating faster than we had previously thought, how optimistic are you that we'll do what's necessary to avoid heating the planet past the point of no return? And what can we all do to help?
So the UN report from a couple of weeks ago was just the latest reminder of what so many of us already know, right? That's why there's a big distinction between California's action on climate versus the rest of the nation. Mm-hmm. You know, other states trying to follow in California's footsteps, but we need a national policy and plan, and of course, you know, collaboration with partners around the world. But we know the blueprint. It's reducing emissions in the electricity sector, in transportation, in, you know, construction and demolition, and so much more. I think what the UN report has done if what it has been able to do is add the urgency back to the equation. It's not a matter of what if. We're seeing what can happen through these wildfires in California. And on the other extreme, ice storms in Texas, you know, a few months ago. Extreme weather patterns on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and the big electrical grid issues with that as well. So climate is a big part of this infrastructure bill that you guys just passed. And we're going to talk about that coming up next. The U.S. passing a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. What's in it for California?
We're asking the senator what's in the massive bill and sharing more of your questions. Stay with us.
We continue our statewide town hall with the senator from California, Alex Padilla. We got questions in all different forms, including on social media. Here's one of them. Megan wrote to us saying, unintended consequences for small businesses are often overlooked by state and federal policy. Would you consider doing regular small business roundtables to better understand the challenges and barriers affecting lower middle class entrepreneurship?
Absolutely. We've done them over the years in my numerous capacities as a member of the city council in Los Angeles, as a state legislator, even as California Secretary of State, partner with businesses to promote nonpartisan, you know, voter participation. And now even more critical, given the challenges of COVID. A lot of resources available for small business owners. Go to padilla.senate.gov and learn more about them. But absolutely got to keep the conversation going. COVID safe, of course.
You've got the branding thing going, man. On message with that Padilla website.
Senator, we talked about EDD earlier in the show and unemployment benefits. We've got a question from Yvette about those benefits ending soon.
For unemployment, if people would be, you know, getting the same benefits as before, is it going to be less money? Because it could affect people like it's already been affecting us.
As this recovery continues, a lot of people are concerned about some of these federal bonuses and benefits ending. So what do you tell her?
Yeah, well, like as I've been asked over the course of several months, you know, what is the right time frame? Is it 2 months of extra help? Is it 5 months of extra help? My answer kept being, it depends, right? It depends on where we are with the pandemic. And I keep going back to not just the health impacts, but the economic impacts of COVID. So if we need to extend those benefits, you know, for the same reasons why we put them in place, you know, last year to begin with, then for me, that's the reason to extend them. If we're sort of recovering from that, the economy's looking better, well, that's a different story, whether it's unemployment benefits, whether it's eviction moratoriums, right? We see what's going on there. When there's a hard and fast deadline that people are worried about, oh my gosh, if I can't afford my rent because I lost my job during the pandemic, you know, we got to be helping people during a crisis, not hurting them.
So that's kind of a complicated issue, right? Because you've got landlords that are saying, we need money, we need to get paid. And then there are people that are saying, well, we don't have the money to pay you. So what do we do? I mean, does the eviction moratorium need to extend it even longer?
Well, I think the president just extended it within the last 10 days.
Right.
So that's good news. It's more, at the national level, it's more in line with the protections that are in place in California,
right,
which are still, you know, for the next several months. Part of what we invested in through the American Response Plan and what we're investing in through this infrastructure package. And so now working with state partners to make sure that money's not just approved, but it's getting through the state into the hands of people who need it. Landlords will be made whole. We just got to make sure that the money keeps moving.
So that's kind of a perfect segue for us as we talk about a lot of the work that you're doing on Capitol Hill as it relates to the infrastructure bill. So when Californians ask you what is in this bipartisan bill for physical infrastructure, what can they expect to see here?
No, great question. And as historic as this bipartisan infrastructure bill that was just approved by the Senate is, we know that it's not enough. And so we'll follow that up with a supplementary package that deals with investing in America's families, not just the physical infrastructure that you're referencing. But what's in this first bill? It's money for transportation and public transit. A lot of jobs going to be created in the process, but let's expand out our rail and bus service, especially in the urban areas of California. Funding for water infrastructure. You know, we're in a drought. We got to make maximum use of the water that we do have. When you lose a lot of it to leaky pipes or other methods of moving water from where we get it to where we need it, we can reclaim a lot of that water through modernizing our infrastructure, resiliency of the electrical grid. We're talking about the impact of climate change. We need to invest in the grid, not just for resiliency during wildfires, but efficiency purposes. We can reduce emissions, move more electrons at the same time by investing in the electrical grid. Broadband deployment, you know, for parts of the state that don't have a good quality internet connection or don't have one at all. We saw how critical that was for all those kids that have been remote learning this last year. So there's all of those items and more in this bipartisan package.
And also just things like roads and bridges, also an electrical charging system for cars around the state as well, which could be an interesting thing. But there's so much money that we're talking about here. I mean, trillions of dollars that you've passed between the COVID relief bill and now the physical infrastructure bill and the human infrastructure bill. It could be $6 or $7 trillion passed in 7 months. And one of our viewers wrote asking, now that we have some funding confirmed for infrastructure, what will be the process in determining the priorities? And can we expect that Congress will have the traditional behind-the-scenes deals that those of us paying will never know about? Basically concerned, when you got this much money being thrown around, somebody's getting the short end of the stick. And somebody who is maybe a lobbyist is getting the long end of the stick.
Yeah, no. So while the bill itself didn't say this project, grant programs or the loan programs that we are funding through this, and the criteria for those puts a lot of projects in California in really, really good shape, like the Purple Line extension here in Los Angeles and Northern California, the BART extension in to San Jose, for example. So yes, devil's always in the details. Part of our job is not just approving the funding, but then staying on top of it to make sure that it goes to worthwhile projects, that California is getting its fair share, of course, in all categories.
What about high-speed rail? Because there are a lot of people that think that is not a worthwhile project and that's a lot of money's been wasted on that, although that was part of the potential negotiations, right?
It is, and I'm supportive of high-speed rail. For folks who have seen, you know, the transit of the future, not just across the country, but across the world, you know, I can't see the United States 100 years from now without some form of high-speed rail. The high-speed rail project in California, this is also important. It's not just a California project. It's a significant leg, and will eventually it's going to be a national network. And so whether it's a standalone independent high-speed rail system, how it plugs into Amtrak, how we're improving Amtrak service in different parts of the country,
That's been frustrating for a lot of people. The idea was that you were going to be able to go from LA to San Francisco. We're not anywhere close to that. It is over budget. It is not following the deadlines. I mean, is that an example of what's working?
It's been started, and it eventually will reach the places that we need it to reach. It is over budget. Can't argue with that. But our point is, from where we are now, how do we bring it to fruition and into service sooner rather than later in the most affordable way?
Senator, we've got another viewer question for you. Janie has a question about infrastructure.
We seem to have a bipartisan support for physical infrastructure, but the Republicans are completely opposed to any sort of human infrastructure. So my question is physical infrastructure useless without human infrastructure? And what do you plan to do about it?
It's a big question on Capitol Hill from Jeannie. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
Yeah, again, so that's why it's not one or the other, it's both. To the extent Republicans are willing to support and participate in the passage of this physical infrastructure bill, we'll take it. You know, I wish everything could be done on a bipartisan basis, but there's a lot of Republicans aren't willing to go vote in favor of. Child care is sort of the big example that people keep pointing to. That's not infrastructure. Since when is that considered infrastructure? It's really hard for people to go back to work if you don't have a safe place to leave your kids, you know, when they're not in school. And so is it part of laying out down the infrastructure for our nation's economic success, for the ability for every working family to be able to do well and prosper? Absolutely. And if Republicans won't vote for it, then we're going to use this budget reconciliation process to invest more in child care, the care economy, education, healthcare, housing, and more.
So when you say child care, let's break that down for people. What exactly does that mean? I have kids. You say child care. How does that help me? What does that mean for my actual life?
Yeah, look, so for parents that have been in the shoes that my wife and I have been in, it's, you know, what do you do in the summers when the kids aren't in school? What do you do when they're not old enough for preschool or kindergarten? Yeah, or even after school, depending on your work schedule. We know childcare is tough to find quality, affordable childcare. So it means not just subsidizing what is, it means building capacity, just like we were talking earlier about building capacity of departments and agencies when it comes to immigration. How do we help train more child care workers and have more child care slots available for the many, many families who need it but can't find it today?
So the government's essentially going to help pay for my babysitter? Or, I mean, what does that look like?
Working with state and local governments to build out that sector, if you will, to provide more child care options, quality child care options. Like, it's in our interest. We know that children, California's been a leader in this, the whole First Five initiative. When children are better prepared going into school, they do better.
Right.
Those first 5 years of life are critical. And that's really what we're talking about, preparing them, not just a safe place, but a quality experience, better able to perform when they get into kindergarten, elementary, high school, and beyond.
Senator, I want to go back to the idea of broadband access for low-income communities, because that's something that you've been passionate about and something that we have sort of seen the inequities as a result of COVID. How impactful is that, not only for distance learning, but people to have access at all?
Yeah, look, as time goes on, it's more and more important for people to have a quality internet connection. Some of this is maybe from the trauma I suffered my freshman year at MIT, when it was very clear that I was not on par with a lot of my classmates when it came to digital literacy, had to catch up quick. But it's not just remote schooling. You know, I think telemedicine is another story of the pandemic. If you've been sick this last year and a half, you call your doctor, the first thing they tell you is don't come in unless you absolutely have to. Right, stay away from the hospital, stay away from the clinic. We'll set up a call with the nurse or a video chat with your doctor. Well, if you don't have a good internet connection, all of a sudden your health care is not comparable to what others are benefiting from. So that's inequitable. It's not just e-commerce. It's not just watching, you know, streaming movies. It's health care. It's education. It's economic opportunity. Broadband connections are hugely critical. And California's on the forefront of deployment and speeds, but not everywhere. And so we're looking forward to taking advantage of these federal dollars in some parts of California as well.
So we've got a sort of a big picture question about the way business is done in Washington. Here's Beverly.
I would ask them, why don't politicians in the government take better care of the public? It seems everything is about money.
Have you noticed that, actually being in the room where it happens and the influence of money?
I like to think not, but again, bigger picture, when you see so many of my colleagues refuse to acknowledge climate change, let alone advance climate change, it's got to make you wonder, because the science is absolutely clear. I think it's twofold. Can we align our priorities and investments better in people in a way for folks to not just understand it, but feel it, feel those benefits? Absolutely. It shouldn't be this hard to invest in housing, healthcare, education. But when it becomes that partisan, that says something. Right. And I also think whether, you know, you're very progressive on this or not, we can all do a better job of communicating what it means for people. So we're caught up in this physical infrastructure, human infrastructure lingo. What people want to know is, you know, hey, between tax credits, you know, and some of what's going to be funded, my cost of living is going to be helped. Right. My monthly bills are going to be lowered because of an investment in healthcare, housing, job training, and more.
So do you have the votes right now to pass both bills? I mean, because we know this is going to come down to getting the Democratic caucus on the same side, Joe Manchin agreeing with Bernie Sanders. You're probably closer to Bernie Sanders, but not all the way there. But do you have the votes? Is the party all together on this?
Interesting, by the way, sitting in meetings with both of them simultaneously, both on budget and voting rights and so much more. Well, the bipartisan bill was just approved by the Senate. So the answer is yes on that one. And I'm highly, highly confident it will pass the House, be on President Biden's desk in the
weeks. Speaking of Pelosi, said you got to pass both at the same time.
So the question is the other one, and I'm highly, highly confident that we'll get the reconciliation bill out, the technical term for the Democrat-only package. Are all the details ironed out? No. But that's, you know, what last week's all-nighter was all about. You know, can we say yes to a $3.5 trillion framework of a plan? Committees are hard at work filling out those details. When we return from this recess in mid-September, hopefully acting on that partisan plan in late September, early October.
What do you tell, though, constituents like Beverly who say this should be about compromise, this should be about finding a way together instead of reconciliation? What is your message to her?
There's that magic C word, compromise. Is it a good word? Is it a bad word? I think here's what we really need to know. Am I willing to work with my Republican colleagues to get things done? Absolutely. But I'm not going to compromise on what I think is important for helping families in California and families throughout the country. People need better shots at a good paying job, not less. That's a big part of what this infrastructure package is all about. Yes, addressing climate, addressing transportation and congestion, et cetera. But if we can create millions of good paying jobs in the process, that's a huge win. And if there's colleagues that aren't willing to go along with a vision like that, and we can work around them to still get it done, then that's what we're doing.
Let's talk about the issue of voting rights, which is something you're really passionate about as a former Secretary of State. There is concern on the Democratic side about what the Republicans are doing in other states. You have a bill to potentially nationalize the election process in certain ways. It has not gotten the support of any Republican colleagues. And then there's questions about whether Democrats should change the Senate rules, change the filibuster to pass it. Where are we at on that? I know you are strongly saying, change the rules, we need to pass this. Some of your colleagues are saying, no, we don't. Where are you at on convincing them?
So I think we're making progress on convincing the last few who are still holding out on the filibuster and accommodating anything short of a 60-vote threshold to better protect our voting rights. And I want to be clear on something. I'm not talking about federalizing elections or nationalizing. What we are trying to create is a baseline of fundamental right to vote and access to the ballot. Right. In California, we got it good on all fronts. Multiple options for how to register to vote.
Right.
Online, automatic, same day. Multiple options for how to cast your ballot. Vote by mail, vote in person, vote early, and have your vote counted. Every voter in the country deserves that same type of access because it's also making our elections more secure for folks who are concerned about election integrity. But that's not what we're seeing in places like Texas or Georgia, where they're trying to manipulate the electoral process to skew the outcomes. And so because our right to vote is so fundamental, then yes, if we need to tweak the rules of the Senate to protect people's right to vote, then let's do that. Some of my colleagues have been reluctant to take that last step, but I think they're seeing the unwillingness of our Republican colleagues to stand up for our fundamental right to vote, and we may be near that breaking point.
So you think that's going to happen? You think that the Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinemas of the world are going to say, all right, let's do a special exemption for voting rights? Is that actually happening?
I think it's still possible. I know they're not saying that today yet. They want to give it another go. And so in the meantime, as we're navigating these budget and infrastructure negotiations, I'm back in another room with, you know, Joe Manchin and Raphael Warnock and Chuck Schumer and others trying to craft a targeted voting rights bill for a vote when we return in September.
Yeah.
Senator, we wanted to go quickly and ask you about, as California prepares to vote in this recall on September 14th, what voters need to know to ensure that their vote will be safe and secure, and things that you and I have talked about many times in this process?
Great. First of all, make sure to vote no when we vote. Make a plan for how you're going to vote. You want to wait till September 14th and vote in person, vote early, or vote by mail, which is really the most convenient way to do it these days. You know, I won't bore you with California has the voting systems that are headed to the higher standard when it comes to election security. But the one thing you can do for a tremendous amount of peace of mind is sign up for tracking your ballot. Go to the Secretary of State's website, sign up to get alerts by phone, by email, or by text message on the status of your ballot, whether it's in the mail on its way to you, or whether it's, you know, you've mailed it back, even an alert when it's been received and when it's been counted and if there's any issues with your ballot.
And last question, you've been in this job about 7 months now. Biggest surprise so far?
Biggest surprise? Has it been 7 months already? My God, time is flying. I think twofold. Number one is the pace, which, you know, you look at the job, it's a big job, a lot of tremendous responsibilities, big issues, but it's also such a unique time to be making this transition and serving in this capacity. Given COVID, you know, given the insurrection of January 6th, That's one. I think the other is, you know, the constant focus on family, making sure that Angela and the boys are doing okay through all this. It's not easy always. We know it's worth it, but it's not without some sacrifice. So appreciate you asking.
Senator Padilla, we want to thank you as always for your time. We know you've been very busy, but thank you for making the trip to L.A. to have this chat with us.
And thank you so much for watching. Have a good night. Our thanks so much for listening to this special edition of the Issue Is podcast. On the regular edition of the Issue Is podcast later this week, our conversation with Governor Newsom. Hope you'll listen for that. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.